The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey there, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. Here we are on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Here every week at this time from 1 to 2, discussing the news that's not in the news, discussing what's being left out, what's being suppressed, and also what's important, what should we know about in the world today. I write the blog NewsDissector.com every day. Online, and you can see my writing. So it's, today it's 3,500 words. I can't seem to stop because there's so much happening in the world. I'm trying to cover the Occupy movement, particularly with lots of references to lots of articles, and that's part of what we're going to be talking about today. We have with us Jeremy Kessler from N Plus One, a tremendous literary magazine published out of Brooklyn, New York, that I picked up at Occupy Broadway. And Occupy Wall Street. It's on off of Broadway. I'm moving too quickly. Jeremy is a writer, so he's brought his computer into the studio, and he can't stop writing. He's like, I'm trying to get him to focus on the program, but maybe he will eventually. In the meantime, we're going to be also joined later in the program by the very funny Lee Camp, who's going to be with us and offer his commentary. He does some great videos. One of them was sent to me by Kat, a member of our team here, and it's hysterical about, you know, the whole idea that you people should get a job, and he's talking about how many people are working so hard in America. Mark Ash of Reader Supported News is supposed to be joining us. We're trying to reach him right now in the, on the West Coast. He was a witness to what happened in Oakland, California. So all of that's coming up today. You can join us on the line at 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. A free call. If you want to share some of your experience, your impressions, your analysis, your fears, your criticisms, whatever it is, you can call in and join me on the radio here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll tell you that this program is also available later on podcast, and we're going to give you the information. It'll be posted up on the PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. So you can actually listen to it if you again, or share it with friends if you like what we're doing here on PRN. So that's the story. That's the lineup. We'll be back in a second with more. But first, a song I picked up at Occupy Wall Street, a rap song, the artist Move Ez. Let's give it a listen.
For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors. And we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive.
I'm moves and I represent the 99%. Yeah. Flashback to a time of an innocent boy. Before the conflict overseas, before the soldiers deployed. Before the economic crisis, then the things are destroyed. Yeah, used to have it good, now you're unemployed. So you gotta pay the bills, now you're wondering how. Or you ain't pick up an illegal substance in a while. Hustle running through your brain, see it started as an option. Times is hard, so it's time to get it popping. No doors open, damn, the walls closing. Gotta keep the damn crib from foreclosing. Kids getting big, outgrowing their clothes, and it's just getting tougher to put something on the stove. Pac said it the best, wish he wasn't in the ground. Seems like there's a plan to keep a mother down. Illuminati for your mind, soul, and your body.
Well, that's Move Ez. He's really cool, and listening to what John F. Kennedy said about the need for debate in society is something that many people in power seem to have forgotten, and he reminds us of it in this incredible CD that I picked up for free at the People's Library at Occupied Wall Street. I didn't know the artist, they didn't know what was in it, but I had a feeling, a gut feeling, this would be cool, and yes, it is cool. Today, on Occupy Wall Street, this just in, apparently 6,000 people are assembling, actually right now, at Bryant Park, near the Public Library in New York. York to bring a message to the 1%. Thousands of Occupy Wall Street protesters will barrage bank CEOs with 6,000 angry letters from the 99%. The mass march will deliver the letters today, meeting up at Bryant Park, marching to the Bank of America headquarters, Morgan Stanley headquarters, Wells Fargo headquarters, Citigroup headquarters, and J.P. Morgan Chase headquarters. Now, there's a danger here. There's a risk here because they don't have a permit. The police department is now insisting that the demonstrators have permits. They say their permit is the First Amendment. What will happen? Will there be a collision in Midtown today? We don't know, but the police department seems kind of testy. That they're you know, on the one hand, seem to be doing their job professionally. On the other hand, a handful of them, often led by the so-called white shirts, the people in charge, are have been abusing protesters. Every time they do, more people join the protests. So that must be very frustrating to them. And now the union, the police union, is threatening to sue Occupy Wall Street, alleging that if Occupy Wall Street beats up any of its policemen, they will sue, you know, the activists, they will sue the mayor, they will sue anybody they can sue, claiming that this violence is being instigated, despite the fact that the movement itself is rigidly nonviolent. And this is another example of sort of blaming the victim, but blaming the victim to the effect of you know, it's their fault. They're the violent ones. They're the ones who are antisocial. Whereas, in fact, the police have been that way. And a person who's been following the police role in all of this very closely is Jeremy Kessler. Jeremy is a student at Yale in a PhD program. I didn't know him, but I read an article, two articles that he wrote in this N+1 literary magazine out of Brooklyn, which was distributed at Occupy Wall Street. And I was knocked out by, first, the publication, how well it's edited, the diversity of views, the personal statements in it. If you can get a copy, please do. You'll be really impressed by it. They also have a website, N+1, where you can check it out. But Jeremy was writing about the police and the 99%. You want to tell us a little bit about your perspective on this?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on the show, Danny. And I'm glad that that N+1 publication is getting around. There's a second issue coming out soon. My original thought on the kind of the relationship between the police and the 99% was basically that the occupation will only get more effective as time goes on. You want more people and you want it to last longer, and that the kind of populist rhetoric of the 99% suggests that you really want as many Americans as possible kind of committed to the movement and committed to its ideas. So the hope was, are there ways to expand the occupation without kind of causing a police crackdown that would cause the occupation to disappear in a kind of early stage? It wasn't so much trying to befriend the police, as I think some folks interpreted it, as how does the occupation relate to the police in the way that the occupation can kind of extend its own lifespan?
Well, understand, I mean, the police are there to impose disorder, as was once said in Chicago by the mayor, Mayor Daley. We are not here to create disorder. We are here to ensure disorder. Something, he bobbled it a little bit, sounding a bit like Joe Biden sounds today. Every time he opens his mouth, something weird comes out. At any rate, the police have had a whole long history of being the front lines in the forces of repression, if you will, in society. But one of the things we're seeing here is kind of interesting, almost a class struggle within the police. You know, the blue shirts, so to speak, the cops who are there, the community relations cops and the regular cops, seem to be sort of doing their job in a fairly good-natured way. Not, you know, unless there's a supervisor who comes up and says, you know, starts harassing them. Get off the corner, Johnny. That you're not allowed on that corner. Keep moving. You know, the old police approach that George Carlin mocked often on his records. I can't do what Carlin can do, but he really captured the flavor of it. But the white shirts, the police commanders, seem very anxious, very aggressive, very anxious to, you know, get this over with. And I'm sure they're reflecting what they're hearing from higher ups and the mayor's office. Let's get these people out of this park, etc. And they're totally exasperated and frustrated by their inability to do so. And when whenever you have frustration, you have aggression, often. Frustration, aggression, old psychological principle. So, Jeremy, how do we communicate to the police if the police, in essence, you know, are kind of institutionally hostile to what's going on?
Right. I think it's actually important at this point, now that the occupation has shown that it's sticking around, at least for some time, to really start to take seriously the claim that you just repeated on air, this idea that our permit is the First Amendment. Because basically, you know, the police are going to be empowered to do what the law empowers them to do. So as soon as you have a law that the police can say you're breaking, you'll get this kind of escalation of conflict that you're describing. The question is, what kind of laws are the occupation supposedly breaking, right? What kind of pretext do the police have for this kind of aggression? And I think, you know, both normal American citizens, but also political and legal and media elites should start questioning this idea that cities under the First Amendment should kind of have the right to place kind of infinite what are called time, place, and manner restrictions on free assembly. So basically, you know, under the First Amendment, there's a right to free assembly. Over the years in American law, it's become severely restricted. So now the basic law is that everyone can assemble, but cities, local officials have the right to prescribe the time, place, and manner of such assemblies. And it's on that basis that, you know, cities are saying, well, we didn't say you could assemble here at this time in this place in such and such a manner. And I think it's one of the things the occupation is doing is asking us, why is this, you know, why is this what the First Amendment has become? And what can we do about it? Because if you change that law, then the police don't have the pretext to do what they're doing.
Well, let's introduce a little reality here from our recent history. I mean, after 9/11 and the Patriot Act and all of the rest of this, repression became, you know, institutionalized in many ways, and the police interpreted a law basically in the interest of you know, stopping terrorism or what have you. We've had a long chain of abuses, often officially sanctioned abuses that have violated people's rights under the First and other amendments. Right. As a consequence, police have sort of assumed power in reality, and this is particularly true in the Wall Street area, where you've had, with the encouragement of the companies down there, various spy centers, surveillance cameras, and a whole kind of no-go zone set up very much like in Northern Ireland, where they officially interpret you're not allowed to protest on Wall Street. I've been involved in a number of marches on Wall Street. Now they are not allowing any. Okay, right. You can't march on the stock exchange. You can't assemble in front of it. You can't assemble in areas that the police say you can't assemble in. Basically, they're the ones arbitrarily making these decisions. And not only that, they're enhancing their surveillance capacity. I mean, there's a whole truck down there, Turu, I think it's called, an agency that is monitoring every single thing in the park, both audio and video. There's a police tower there, which is also shooting and monitoring everybody. So, you know, when they're there doing this 24 hours, 24/7, they can monitor, identify, slow down the tape, single out various people. And the consequence of that is that those people could be subject to subsequent crackdowns and violations of their rights. So we're dealing with institutionalized police, in a sense, neglect of the First Amendment. They're, you know, in the interest of, quote, security is uber alles, is above, you know, the rights of Americans to protest.
I think that's right. And although the technology, you know, has definitely changed and police presence is far more pervasive, you know, I think that some old paradigms of protest that we were talking about before we went on air still provide, you know, kind of the pattern and the strategy of what needs to happen. You need more and more people down there. You need more and more people at Bryant Park, you know, going on these direct actions and basically kind of press, you know, press the limit of the police response. And then, you know, the question is always going to be, what do politicians do? You know, what do are the nation's leaders or the city's leaders, in the first case, shamed into doing what's right and changing, you know, the kind of license they give to the police? So I think that's really, you know, I think that's really what has to happen.
There's a bit of naivete down there and the sense of inexperience in dealing with a political situation.
Among the protesters.
In New York City, correct. Because of the decentralization, no leaders, sort of spontaneity, uber alles and whatnot, there seems to be a lack of recognition that the police themselves are not a monolithic force. Mm. There are organizations of black and Hispanic police officers, for example, who presumably could be a lot more sympathetic to the objectives of the marchers because they know the economic conditions in their own communities. And they might, you know, prevail here if they were approached with any sophistication. There are members of the city council from various very poor neighborhoods all over Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and elsewhere who could be approached to intervene with the city administration. Yes, we have a strong mayor who's been reelected because he had a lot of money. We know that, but we also have other countervailing potential forces. I'll give you an example. Up in Albany, New York, there's a progressive district attorney who is basically saying he will not prosecute anyone who's arrested. You can arrest them all day long, but I'm not going to put them in jail. And so you have these cleavages, these conflicts within the system that could be exploited if people understood where they were and how they are. And so the idea of, I mean, there should be community relations group among the protesters to communicate with the police instead of taking this notion, well, we can do anything we want because of the First Amendment. If there's some reach out, just as there was to the community board when people were saying this place is filthy, it needs to be cleaned up, blah, 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 and people responded to that by setting up a new conduct of, you know, a good conduct pledge and working with the community to try to, you know, in a way, this de-escalate things that people objected to, like the drum circles going all the time or what have you. So it's, you know, it seems to me that while you can't necessarily stop the police, you could attempt to reach out to progressive police officers and people who have spoken out in criminology. We have in New York, you know, John Jay College, which is a college of criminology, where people teach the police officers. Those professors could potentially help in this situation. There needs to be some sort of bridge there. If it's a straight confrontation, one-on-one, us versus them, we're going to lose, okay? I mean, history shows us that. Although, even though there's often a boomerang effect afterwards. I mean, you have in Oakland, California, a case where the police basically went berserk. Right. Now a Marine, you know, former Marine is Eric Olson, I guess his name. Is that right? Eric? Who is in a coma as a result of this. I mean, they actually attacked, of all people, you know, a returning veteran from Iraq, you know, who was among the Occupy. So there's a tremendous swing of sympathy against the city authorities. And in my blog today, I report, you know, that the mayor of Oakland now says she supports Occupy Wall Street. The police chief in Oakland says that they're investigating themselves, you know, about how this could happen and get out of control.
Right. I mean, I think the debate that has been going on within the occupation from the very beginning is what is the more effective strategy? Is the more effective strategy to try to understand that the state is not a monolith, as you're saying, and to try to appeal to certain groups of the police, to certain people within the city government, or is that itself maybe too naive, and is the only effective strategy basically kind of escalating the intensity of the situation such that you produce Oaklands and then you produce backlash? Well, and what my original intervention was sort of saying, well, that second strategy could really backfire, you know, because you could lose the movement before it gets going. Maybe the answer is a diversity of tactics.
Why does it have to be one thing or the other? Either or. It doesn't necessarily. Right. But it takes a little bit of understanding of who you're dealing with here and how to deal with them. And the problem here is that in dealing with a police force which tends to operate like a military force, right? We're only following orders.
Yes.
We're told to do this, we do it, you know, kind of thing. You have a situation where you want to try to divide them if possible. You want to try to complicate their task. I mean, one of the big things complicating their task right now is the polls, you know, that are showing as many as 47% of the people, to at least 3-1 in New York, maybe more, supporting the objectives of Occupy Wall Street. They're supporting it because it hasn't been violent or it hasn't been you know, something that they can't feel they can support. And, you know, of course, they're being attacked by Fox News with intensity, partly because they're being so effective in communicating their goals. But, you know, once this issue becomes us versus the cops, then the issues of economic power of the 1% and 99% get lost.
Yes.
And it's all about, you know, tear gas in the night. I have a essay up on Al Jazeera English, the website of Al Jazeera, which reaches a worldwide audience about this whole issue. It's called Eyes on the Prize, and it's about what we learned in the civil rights movement. You know, the police helped build the civil rights movement. Bull Connor in Birmingham, and Jim Clark in Selma, Alabama. You know, vicious Southern police chiefs became the symbols of you know, the old order, and, you know, attracted tremendous sympathy for the movement. So in a way, they played a positive role. On the other hand, a lot of people were both killed and beaten badly,
right,
as a result of that. We don't want that. So there has to be some middle ground here. I mean, one of the things that this movement has proven is that this issue of economic justice is very popular.
Yes. I think people who say, what will Occupy Wall Street, what are they going to accomplish, you know, it all seems so utopian. I mean, it just seems very clear that there's already been quite a substantial change in the national conversation. I mean, it's already accomplished a significant change in folks' consciousness. People are no longer ashamed, as they were, I would say, a month ago, to talk about their economic hardships, you know, whether that's debt overhang or kind of periodic unemployment.
Student loans,
you know, and you know, some critics from the center and the right say, oh, these people with their student loans, they're not poor. You know, that's so disingenuous, because those folks on the center and the right weren't helping poor folks anyway. So now what you're just seeing is more and more people are realizing that they are to some extent victims of, you know, a profoundly unjust economic system.
And also other issues that never had a mass base, if you will, issues of the banks and the power of the banks and the corruption on Wall Street and the fraud on Wall Street has been kind of covered up, papered over in many ways. And even now, you know, you have, I'm reading The Economist here, you know, people are right to be angry, they say, but it's also right to be worried about where populism could take politics. My goodness, too many people demanding their rights could make it a mess for the professional politicians.
Right.
And you have issues like, you know, Kat has been concerned about the Federal Reserve Bank and other issues which, you know, people weren't really hearing. And now these are issues that are being raised in the streets and raised by Occupy Wall Street, which are important. The other day, we had, speaking down there, William Black, a former federal regulator, came down to the park. And his whole analysis is fraud and the role of fraud in the financial crisis, something I wrote about, by the way, in this book, The Crime of Our Time, that I've written, which is an effort to try to put the crime narrative up front. And Black was there and had a tremendous response from the crowd. David DeGraw introduced him. I mean, it was a big crowd listening to his analysis, explaining in detail how, you know, CEOs manipulate the economy of their companies, show rapid profits, use those big profits to give themselves higher compensation and bonuses, and in a sense loot their own companies.
Right.
And the companies then, you know, kind of collapse, or they need bailouts and the rest in order to survive. I mean, this whole point about what happened, why the banks suddenly needed all these bailouts, had to do with their, you know, irresponsible lending policies and their crooked internal practices, lack of accountability and the like. Now we see a new arrest of a top Wall Street guy for insider trading. But you see, these insider trading cases are really there to protect investors, not the public, not, you know, not the people, so to speak, who have lost jobs and lost homes. So the government is still not responding to this. And, you know, President Obama is saying, well, he understands their frustration, but he has backed away from supporting them. Unfortunately, we're having some problems reaching Mark Ash, who was in Oakland and actually wrote an account on Reader Supported News about what actually happened there. And, you know, it's an ongoing story. You know, there's a now backlash against the city government in Oakland, and more people are joining the movement. On the other hand, and this is the last point I wanted to raise with you, Jeremy, is there's concern that because people in their beneficence, say, to, you know, because they want a better society, are offering free food, are offering support. Other people who are, shall we say, not really in accord with the movement, but have, you know, desperate needs or want to scam people, are in the parks now, and there's a danger of violence, there's a danger of all kinds of tensions. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think those issues will continue to be a real test of some of the premises of the movement, which is that folks can organize themselves and kind of can conduct themselves in a politically productive, socially productive way without a police state, you know, without kind of the inequalities in economic and political power. You know, my sense is clearly you are going to always hear the worst of those reports in the media. You know, every time there is a theft or, you know, a violent encounter, be sure that you'll hear about it.
Did you see that article about, I caught a cold down at Occupy Wall Street. It was like front page in the New York Times.
Yeah, right.
covered the Occupalooza comedy festival that Randy Credico put on the other night at the Yippie Museum. And it was all about how these critics were making fun of Occupy Wall Street when they were really there to support Occupy Wall Street. So they were quoted out of the larger context of what the event was about. And I spoke there also, paying tribute to Abby Hoffman, who you know, threw money on the stock exchange years before all of this and targeted Wall Street. And, of course, that didn't make the article, boo-hoo. At any rate, I wasn't surprised. Jeremy, how can people read your work? Give us the information.
Sure. Well, all of my work is posted on my Tumblr, which is Jeremy K. Kessler .tumblr.com. But also, they should definitely check out N Plus One magazine. If they just Google N Plus One, that'll come up. And there's a lot more writing to be done. There's a lot more discussion to be done. I have a piece, a big topic that a lot of folks have been talking about. What's the relationship between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street? Is the Occupy Wall Street the left Tea Party? This kind of conversation. I have a piece coming out about that in the magazine The Utopian, which is run out of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for joining us here. You bring a fresh perspective, a younger perspective, you know, being younger than Kat and myself. I know, I'm just kidding, Kat. Okay.
Just by a few years.
I'm just kidding. But, we're really wanting to continue this conversation, and we think it's important. There are a lot of issues out there. They're not really discussed in the mainstream media from people who are sympathetic to the objectives of Occupy Wall Street. And I'm really happy that you came on. I hope maybe you can come back and we can continue this discourse. I really recommend the Jeremy's articles. You'll find them very well written and very provocative, and you'll learn something from them, as I did. Okay, we'll be back in a minute with more on News Dissector Radio.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold. When Wall Street stepped into the fold, Congress paid off, workers paid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking to AAA. Grandpa knows his 401k.
Well, that's the theme song, Plunder, from my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, which looks at the financial crisis as a crime story, not, you know, as simply a business problem where, you know, some people made mistakes, you know, or they were just too greedy, and, you know, this whole analysis where everybody was greedy, therefore nobody was greedy, therefore there's no one to prosecute. I'm kind of challenging that thesis, and I do so in my film and a companion book, The Crime of Our Time. Are we going to some breaks now? Maybe we are. Matt isn't with us in the house, and then we'll be back in a second.
Oh, ain't no joke for real, I know. in the show. I'm all night, can't sleep right, my head's tight. Got my food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do? My credit card's full, and it's due. No job, no time, no reason, no rhyme. Gotta get it together before I'm a mess. Walk the line between ruin and success. That's no joke.
That's no joke. For real, I'm broke. I try to feature some of the music that I've been involved with to kind of spice up the show, but also to show you that there's a lot of music that's very relevant to the issues that we're talking about. And hopefully this music by Polarity One will interest you. And you can, if you're interested, if anybody wants a CD of music about the economy, I'm willing to give away three of them. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. And tell me where to send it to. If you are so disposed, why wouldn't you be? It's free music and it's cool music. Anyway, we're here. Lucas is joining us. Kat is in the house. Jeremy is staying with us. And we're welcoming Lee Camp. Lee, you've been down at Occupy Wall Street. You've done a video about it. Give me your take on it.
Pleasure to be on here with you. I think it's amazing. I'm proud to say I was very wrong months ago when I did a video saying America could never stand up like the people in Egypt had, because how long could we stand in a square chanting for freedom before people realized they were missing Glee? So I'm pretty excited to see that I've been quite wrong, and being down there, like the energy, it's amazing. I feel like people have been waiting for this for a long time, and it's fine. The energy's there, the movement's there. It's impressive.
You guys join in if you want. I mean, one of the issues that I think you touch on, Lee, is what makes this unique? Why have so many earlier protest movements around these issues not caught steam, not really grown? And why is this continuing and sustaining and staying there? And it's, I think, partly this idea of a community, that you could be part of something, that you're an identity with being part of the 99%, having the right, you know, to challenge the 1%, the people who have, you know, ripped all of us off for so many years. And I think when you go to the park, you find it welcoming. You find it interesting. You meet people. You start a conversation. I'm talking to Kat. Somebody else jumps in or, you know, and has an opinion to throw into the mix. And, you know, it becomes a kind of a real classic town square as we, you know, envision them and kind of the history of democracy. You agree with that, Lee?
Yeah. And I think one of the strengths, you know, you're talking about what makes this one different, I think the strengths are what the mainstream media keeps criticizing about, which is the fact that it doesn't fit in the paradigm they're used to covering. It's not the right and left. There's not a lot of people marching around with signs that say, yay Democrats. Like, this is not about right and left. It's about 99% standing up against the 1% that now control our government. Yeah. And so I think that's what makes it very different, and also what gives it strength. Same thing with it being leaderless. They love to criticize, oh, it's leaderless. But, you know, if you give something a leader, it's a lot easier to end it. Because yeah, once that leader's either arrested or criticized or ridiculed, then it's over.
Yeah, Lee, we're going to try to call you back on another line. You're breaking up a little bit here. Jeremy, thoughts on this community aspect?
I think the very idea of an occupation is crucial. The idea of going out of doors and staying out of doors. You know, I think just in a very technical and physical sense, this is different than the protests we've
seen.
It's
colder. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, it's harder on the body. It's not just, it's a spectacle, but it's more than a spectacle. It's saying we're going to do politics on our own terms, out of doors. And although that's novel, you know, in the last maybe 10 years or 20 years, I do think that's part of a robust American tradition. You know, going back to the kind of pre-revolutionary days when folks were dissatisfied with the government and really felt disempowered, they would go outside and they wouldn't leave until, you know, they felt their voices were heard.
Kat?
And talk about transparency. I mean, what could be more transparent than people out in the open?
Right.
You know, with their bedrooms and their kitchens and where they live, just outside. That's transparency.
Lucas?
wait to comment a little bit later on.
Okay. He's hesitant to say anything too controversial to show why we're all wrong, you know. But, you know, it seems to me that what you have here is the sense of a movement that is there, that has established itself. It's not something that assembles once every 6 months, marches on Washington, and dissipates. There's actually a presence, and I think that makes a difference. It also threatens the media in a way, because they don't have a category to kind of drop it into, to label it with. As a consequence, it makes them uncomfortable. That's why they go looking around, sniffing about, you know, for the weird, okay? His name is Mr. Germ. He's standing on Broadway, you know, just basically all kinds of coverage that's there to distance the protest from the readers and the viewers. But even that seems to have changed as the media people got down there and realized how sincere and committed the folks there are. Lee, you bring a sort of satirical perspective to some of this, and, you know, I would expect you to be, like, sarcastic about it, but you don't seem to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm as a comedian, I have my funny moments, but sometimes, you know, in a serious discussion, I just have to listen to my heart and then have to be straightforward about it. But, you know, I did a video, one of my Moment of Clarity videos the other day on how people, the right wing loves to say, why don't they stop whining and just get a job, or just why don't they just work hard? If they're so upset, work hard. And what I think they're overlooking is that people are working really hard. Like, there's a lot of, you know, bodega owners and cashiers and janitors and librarians, and they're working really hard, and all they want to do is afford to feed and clothe their kids. And, you know, my point is, first of all, that's the moral thing to do, and secondly, is that with the size of our kids, none of us want to see them half-clothed. So I think it just makes sense, you know? People are working hard. That's the problem. They're working hard, and the game is rigged against them.
You know, it's also people down at Occupy Wall Street are working really hard. A lot of people are out of work and, you know, are looking for something meaningful to do. They're working really hard to make this point, you know, and show their dissatisfaction and create this larger movement. So to dismiss them as a bunch of, you know, lazy hippies or college students really is a horrible discredit to, you know, the tireless work that people are doing. If you go down there, you see the library, the tech center, you know, the way that they structure the general assemblies, the way the movement has spread. So it's really a lot of people working really hard around the clock. And I think the other interesting thing is that the occupation, maybe one reason why it's so successful, is that it mirrors really what people perceive as a corporate financial occupation of the government that's occurring at the same time, and that's really what we're trying to protest against. So I think this kind of confrontational nature of it is really successful because they parallel each other. They say, okay, the government's occupied, let's give it right back to them like that.
There's a duality, though. You know, on the one hand, the enemy is in sight, you know, two blocks away. I mean, the symbolic center of American and global financial power is right there. Wall Street as a target is not something you have to totally explain to everybody, because they understand that some people are getting very rich while they're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, they're losing, you know, their bank accounts and the rest of it. So it's not a big stretch to explain this necessarily. And, you know, the people don't need to do it the way an economist would do it. They need to do it in terms of how this is affecting them in their personal lives. So that's part one. But the other part of it is, in a way, Occupy is an attempt to create the kind of society we want to live in. We want to see a society that,
right,
in which people respect each other, a society in which people work to help each other. I mean, all these working groups and committees are there to serve the people. You know, they have a concierge called Comfort. You know, if you're staying down there, you need a washing, you know, a cloth or something like that. They have it in stock. They have socks. They have all kinds of donated clothes for the people who were down there. There's a kitchen, you know, that's feeding everybody around the clock, which is pretty amazing. Not only that, they have some gourmet chefs in there. The New York Times actually reviewed the food. It's pretty good. So, you know, maybe that's drawing more and more people for free food down
there.
That's
the way to get the Times attention.
You know.
Open a restaurant.
Right. You know, I mean, the New York Times probably has more writers writing on food than they do, you know, on financial fraud, certainly. But, you know, this is something that is impressive. And the security down there, I talked to the guy from security. He says, you know, our goal is to defuse conflict, not to, you know, punish people. It's to try to protect, on the one hand, and defuse tension and the rest of it. And the guy was like a martial arts expert, you know, some Japanese martial art that I never heard of, you know, but he's, you know, like, looks like a palooka. He looks like he's out of, you know, some comic strip, bald and, you know, strong and all the rest of it. And he's extremely knowledgeable about how to try to defuse conflicts, because there have been some conflicts there. It would be amazing if there wasn't. We also know that there probably are so-called agent provocateurs down there, people working for the police or for right-wing groups that are trying to stir up trouble. So,
yeah, actually, we were when I was at down with Occupy DC in the October 2011 movement, we were doing a march protesting the drone aircraft exhibit, and then they ended up pepper spraying everyone. And within an hour after it happened, the guy who pushed one of the guards and essentially got everyone pepper sprayed wrote a article for a right wing blog saying how he was. How great a job he'd done being a provocateur, and how he'd, you know, gotten everyone pepper sprayed. So he was quite proud of it.
So it's all that, you know, it's all that obvious in a way. On the other hand, you know, what I find, you know, both frustrating and refreshing, you know, is a kind of naivete there, not paranoia. You know, paranoia paralyzes people. You know, it has them in fear. There's a lot of optimism there. There's a lot of positivity. When you go to the meetings and you hear people discuss and argue about all of this, it's really impressive. Even I interviewed a guy on the finance committee. You know, they had $436,000 in the bank. And, of course, he's being criticized by everybody. We need some of it. And, you know, they have rules that, you know, you can't get more than $100 unless the General Assembly approves it. You know, so he doesn't have the personal authority to disburse the money or to steal it, really. But, you know, there's an effort there to do everything in a way that's very transparent. They're planning to put all the receipts online so people can see where the money's going and how it's being spent, because there are expenditures there. You know, you have a lot of rain. Computers get rained on. They get destroyed. I mean, there's been an effort there to operate all of this, but nobody's getting paid as far as I know. On the other hand, money is coming in because people are donating it generously.
They're getting paid in a different kind of way.
That's a good way to put it.
They're working now and benefiting. They're actually benefiting from their efforts, like more than just working for money like you're trying to do before.
You know, Lee, one of the things I've observed is, like, kids from schools being brought there by their teachers, you know, like with little notebooks, right? Like, what's going on here? You know, and you get into a conversation with them. They're extremely open-minded. They're very interested in, like, what's going on. They've never seen anything like this in their life. I mean, don't forget, this is a much younger generation that was, you know, far post-civil rights, post-anti-war generation. And they're, like, blown away by it in a way, you know, and some of them are coming back and taking part in it. And what's interesting is, you know, people write their own protest signs up. It's not like groupthink. It's like encouraging individuals to express themselves.
And the way it has spread all over the country and the world shows how much support there is for it. And, you know, I've performed at Occupy DC, Occupy Ohio University with a small band of devoted students and faculty, and Occupy Montreal and Toronto, and it's really kind of global, and there's these people in every city that are devoted to, you know, forming a new way of living in which it's not all greed, in which it's not, you know, people are accepting of other lifestyles, and it's really an amazing community in each one of these cities, and they each are a little bit different, but a lot alike, and it's really amazing.
You know, Occupy Bensonhurst is coming, I think. But listen, you know, here's the deal about this. People can take action themselves. They can take, you know, organize things and do. If you can't do an occupation, do a forum, do a panel, do a screening. My film Plunder is one film that could be screened. There are others. You know, try to do something to do outreach and educate your neighbors. And one of the things that Occupy Wall Street was doing, they were actually going into the subways and, you know, in between stops, talking to the people in the subway cars. I don't know what kind of response they've gotten, you know. The mariachi band that was in the car of mine coming up here didn't do that well this morning, but maybe people will respond because they're not looking for money, they're looking for interest in what they're doing. And, you know, I mean, Lee, have you ever heard of anything like this? Is a protest less than 30 days old inspiring solidarity actions in 900 or 1,000 cities all over the world?
I've never seen anything remotely like it. I mean, I'm young, and this is one of the first things in my lifetime I've ever seen like this. And it is interesting because, you know, I was on one of the marches in New York, and it was kind of we'd gotten split off from the rest of the group, so it was kind of only 50 or 60 of us. And most people off to the side that kind of just happened to see us marching by were very supportive, and they would cheer. And then occasionally you'd run into somebody who was like usually outside one of the wealthy bars, and they would start screaming angrily at us. This happened 3 or 4 times, like curse words and all this stuff. And like to evoke that kind of anger because we're saying, you know, let's live in a better, more fair society is it's tremendous. I think it's scary to them that it can't, that this, and to the mainstream media, that this can't be put in the box they're used to putting it in, you know, either right wing or left wing. And I think it's scary to some people. It's amazing.
Well, you know, we do have, believe it or not, a class structure in our society, a social stratification of people. People who have more money tend to be maybe less socially conscious, but not necessarily. There are many people who are. That's one of the problems with the 1%, 99%, you know, separation, because you'll find among the 99% people who are not sympathetic to this, and among the 1% people who are sympathetic to this. So, you know, you can't classify, but as a slogan, it touches on something that I think people do respond to, which is namely that this society has become more and more unequal, more and more a way in which the super rich are controlling everything in their own interests and with their own bonuses and benefits and all the rest of it. And the working class is, you know, being hurt, and the middle class is shrinking to nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that although clearly the kind of the, most of the concerns you hear from the occupation is naturally economic, and you know that's a source of a lot of discontent in America right now. I think one of the reasons that explains its sort of global popularity and the quickness with which it spread is that it really arises from a feeling of political disempowerment. You know, the sense that there's a lot of bad stuff going on economically, but we can't even, you know, really have that conversation in an efficacious way because we don't really even have any access to the political structure.
Our governments are not representative, are dominated by lobbyists and special interests, and, you know, are manipulated organizations and institutions. So we see this in Washington with great clarity. And I'm not, you know, the Democrats are nothing to boast about, you know, when it comes to talking about all of this. They are also part of this whole system and part of, in a sense, covering it up, you know, not wanting to be responsible. There are great people in government who are speaking up, you know, but you know, one of the leaders, of course, is Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who's an independent, probably a socialist, you know. So you have a lot of groupthink in politics and fear, you know, particularly like we see in the White House, fear of like speaking out in support of this because there might be a backlash, always trying to placate the Republicans, bipartisan, you know, trying to, and every time the president does that, the right wing just hammers him more. They don't really go along with him. They don't really make a deal with him. We're in a society which has been polarized largely by media, by Fox News, by right-wing talk radio, Rush Limbaugh's and all the rest of it, where there's a war underway. It's more less a political debate than a war. And it's vicious. It can be extremely vicious. Sometimes it can be very vicious on the left, too, with people, you know, in essence, you know, demanding a level of purity on the part of people, and when they don't live up to what their notion of purity is, they basically turn against them. So that's part of the problem.
They love to call it class warfare if we you know, raise the tax by 1% on the top 1%. But what is it other than class war to take away people's health care and their pensions and, you know, that this class war has been going on for a long time now, and they're claiming it's class war to even it out.
Well, listen, guys, you look at the clock, which I always try to tell.
Where's their permit?
Well, we have a permit, and it's over in a minute. So I want to just thank everybody for being here with us this morning, this afternoon, Lee Camp, for joining us, Jeremy
Thanks.
Kessler for dropping in. I'm sorry
Thanks,
we missed Mark Ash, Lucas, Catherine, myself, Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You can hear the podcast on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. You can offer your suggestions and your criticisms. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com has a lot of information about my book and video. And, you know, we need to build this movement together. We need to talk to each other. We need to talk with each other. We need to reach out to people who are not clear about what this is all about and try to explain it to them in a way that's not threatening, that's not a put down, but it's a way that engages their interest and engages their solidarity. And that's what we're trying to do. I'll be back next week at this time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Thanks so much for joining us. That's it for now. Bye-bye.
To chase and to war.